Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode was sponsored by Book of the Month, which is a curated book subscription that offers five new and early release books to choose from each month. I've personally used Book of the Month before. It is a great way to discover new authors.
Yeah, now that we're all locked indoors for the foreseeable future, there's never been a better time to pull up an extra book to read in addition to our usual Books and Boba Book Club picks. Book of the Month's editorial team chooses their books, vetting them from hundreds per month, and you, as a subscriber, can choose up to three books each month for them to ship right to your door.
And also, Book of the Month is commitment-free. You can skip a month if you don't find any books that you want to read, and you can save those as credits for next month. And this month's selection of books are Beach Read by Emily Henry, The Guest List by Lucy Foley, Valentine by Elizabeth Wetmore, The Library of Legends by Janie Chang, and The Paris Hours by Alex George.
Check out their website at bookofthemonth.com to learn more about the book picks. And you can also get your first month's book for just $9.99 with the promo code BOOKSANDBOBA, all caps lock. Again, the website is bookofthemonth.com, and you can get your first month's book for just $9.99 with the promo code BOOKSANDBOBA.
And now to our episode.
You're listening to Potluck.
And welcome back to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Ye.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And today we have an author interview for you. We're interviewing Eileen Wong, also known as her pen name, I.W. Gregorio. Eileen, if you remember, was the author of one of our earlier book club picks, None of the Above, about a girl who finds out that she's intersex. And we're really excited that her second book is coming out soon. Rira has already read it and is a big fan.
And for those of you who don't know what the book is about, This Is My Brain in Love. It's told in two perspectives. Will, who is mixed race, his mother is Nigerian and his father is Italian-American, and is from an upper middle class family, and he is diagnosed with anxiety disorder. And he falls in love with Jocelyn, who is Chinese-American. She's the daughter of Chinese immigrants who run pretty much the only Chinese restaurant in their town in central New York. And she is undiagnosed with depression. So it's a very interesting love story, in my opinion. So I was really excited to talk to Eileen.
Yeah, we talked to her all about the book, about her work, and also about her her background as a... I forgot about this until I read up on her bio to prepare for this interview, but she is an actual bona fide doctor.
Yeah, she went to school for it and everything.
Which makes her just all the more impressive. And we had a really good conversation with her about writing, about the book, and also about the need for diverse books. So yeah, please enjoy our interview with Eileen Wong. And we're here with Eileen Wong, aka I.W. Gregorio, whose new book, This Is My Brain in Love, comes out next Tuesday. Welcome to the show, Eileen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. How are you doing during this this weird and strange time.
It's a very interesting time. As you may know, I'm a doctor. And so I am in this strange position where I know that my skills are needed, but because I'm a subspecialist, I'm actually a urologist. So you can insert joke there. so I actually am a lot less busy than I used to be because hospitals have stopped all elective surgeries. So I'm only doing emergency surgeries, which luckily in urology are relatively few and far between. And I'm talking to most of my patients over the phone or video and telehealth, which is also interesting because it really changes the dynamic of the doctor-patient relationship. It's kind of harder to get people's stories. But at the same time, I feel like it's at least a good thing for my patients. A lot of them are just so grateful to talk to someone else, you know? It's a strange though. The surge in my part of the country will probably start next week or the week after, literally right around my launch date. And so there have been rumblings about them, my hospitals pulling, you know, even specialists, into the intensive care units if necessary. So
yeah,
that's a little bit frightening because I have two young kids, but, it's a world that we're living in right now.
Yeah, I know that's something that the doctors, the hospitals are doing here in California. You're based in Pennsylvania, I believe?
Yeah, and Philly is one of the new hotspots, for sure.
Well, hope you stay safe. And
So you're a doctor. How did you start writing? It's such a different career, you know?
Yeah, well, I always used to say, you know, a lot of people ask me, so how did a doctor become a writer? And I think the better question to ask is really, how did a writer become a doctor? Because I've always wanted to be a writer since I was really young. I was a complete book nerd when I was growing up. I used to always joke that my best friends were always characters in books. Since I was, 6 or 7 years old, I remember writing my first short story for a second-rate anthology, and seeing my book, my words, in print, at that time. And ever since then, I always, you know, in my dreams, I always thought that I was going to be a writer because I wanted to sort of create those friends that other kids could turn to for comfort. But as I got older, you know, reality kind of set in. I grew up with my grandparents actually, who, you know, grew up in the Depression and, were, you know, immigrants. And so they were very, very pragmatic and they were basically like, so you're good at writing, but how are you going to feed yourself? And so, my grandfather was a doctor. And so he very strongly pushed me towards the sciences. And because, you know, I had some aptitude for it. I did end up double majoring in English and biochemistry in college, which is not a double major that you see often, but that worked for me because sort of around that time, I realized that medicine and writing could absolutely be melded. I have some great role models from that aspect, you know, from the literary world. There's like Chekhov was a physician author. So was William Carlos Williams. And then there are great surgeon essayists like Richard Seltzer and Sherwin Nuland, who won a National Book Award a while ago, Abraham Verghese. Like these are all role models that I kept as an inspiration. So throughout college and even medical school and residency, I was doing a lot of writing. I mostly turned towards like essay writing and feature writing. I wrote some profiles of patients, for instance, a quadruple amputee who was like also a drummer in a rock band that I met while I was at Stanford. I wrote an op-ed about microbicides and AIDS awareness because I did some work in South Africa. But I didn't really turn to novel writing until my residency program when I had a research year. And it actually came about because I got really depressed during that research year. Because that's the sort of gap year during residency where you're not really seeing patients, where you're stuck in a lab often, you know, massacring small animals. And I got really sad, and depression is something that I have struggled with, for most of my life. It was actually my therapist who I was speaking to one day, and I was talking about how I was, you know, really not excited about my program. And she asked me, okay, so what do you think you would be if you weren't a doctor? And I said, oh, I would be a writer. And immediately she said, oh no, you don't have the personality to be a writer. And I was like, what are you talking about? And I was so mad. And that was like the gauntlet. That was like, I'm going to prove you wrong. I was so incensed by that. And that's when I actually started writing my first novel, which, interestingly enough, was a very thinly veiled autobiography of an Asian American nerd growing up in Central New York. That first book, it was my first novel. So I didn't really expect it to be great, but I did get an agent with it. And we actually went on submission. But three different editors said, oh, we love the concept. We love the writing, the voice, but it's too similar to another Asian American book on our list.
Oh, no.
That was one of the things that really inspired me when We Need Diverse Books came along to be part of that movement. My second novel was actually almost perfectly just this, a book that in some ways only I as a physician writer could have written, because it was inspired by an actual patient that I treated who found out when she was 17 that she was intersex, neither male nor female biologically, but something in between. She had something called androgen sensitivity syndrome, where she phenotypically, she grew up thinking she was a girl and she identified as a female. She had XY chromosomes and no uterus and internal testes. And so I actually participated in a surgery to remove her testes. And that was a real eye-opening experience for me, not because of surgery, which is very straightforward, but because of the care of her afterwards. I saw her in clinic and I realized that it was sort of a failure in medicine that I've never really had to think about or was educated on how to care for intersex patients beyond their medical procedures, to think of them holistically, to like introduce them to people to support, because so many intersex kids have been subjected to surgeries before in the hope because it will reduce parental stress or child's, or stress of the patient. But in fact, most of the medical developments in intersex care happened just because of the internet, because they were able to connect with other people and establish a sense of identity and community that is much more healing than any medical intervention that we could do for most kids. So that inspired me because I basically wanted to write a YA Middlesex. And that's what I did. That was my first novel, None of the Above.
Yeah, we actually, it was one of our earlier picks for our book club, and we were really glad to read a story like that.
I saw that. I was so excited when I saw that.
Oh, man, so many things that you just said, we really want to touch on later on, especially talking about We Need Diverse Books. But personally, as someone that has Notorious on this podcast said that I don't really read much YA, even though I read a bunch of YA for the book club. What drew you to wanting to write in YA?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, when I was growing up, books were my best friends. They were the vehicles through which I was able to inhabit other people's lives and learn about the world. And I mean, books basically established my moral code. You know, I don't think that I would be as, open and accepting and liberal as I were now if it weren't for books. And youth, those years between whenever kids start reading and when they have to start thinking about college, those are the formative years of people's lives. And those are when they can read the most. I'm often really ashamed to admit how many books I actually read because, I have a job and kids and other responsibilities. I have three jobs essentially. But I remember when I was a teenager, I would read a book a day, literally. And those are the books that made me who I was, who I am as a person. And what I realized that I wanted to do is I wanted to create books that I needed as a teenager, because there was never really a book that reflected who I was. There were a couple of scattered books about Asian American kids, but usually they were very different immigration stories than mine was. I was growing up in Central New York, very red part of New York, where I was really the only Asian American person there, except for one or two others. But a lot of books were set in sort of a Chinatown, like Lawrence Yep. And a lot of the stories were very, very different than mine were, because I was definitely a banana. my grandparents actually immigrated from South Africa, believe it or not. And their primary language was English. And so they were always it was always easier for them to assimilate. And so it was easier for me to as well. And I never really gained a sense of my cultural identity until college, when I went to University of Pennsylvania, which has a very large Asian American population. So I always wanted to write books that reflected who I was growing up. And I also really believe in the power of books to create conversations, which is why None of the Above was such an important book for me, because it, I hope that all of my books are what I like to call blueberries, where they're like nutritious for you. They're superfoods, but they're also tasty. Like, you can eat them for dessert. They're easy to put down, as it were, easy to eat, and you're happy to eat it. But you can hopefully read through my books relatively quickly, in that hopefully you don't want to put it down.
Yeah. Okay. Follow-up question, because it's something I'm trying to figure out on my own too. How would you define what a YA story mm-hmm. is? Like, what makes a story YA?
Yeah, I think stories, YA is a subcategory that is so wide. It encompasses so many subgenres. But I think that the key thing is that the perspective is usually from a young adult. There are certainly books written from younger points of view, but that are still adult books. For instance, I'm thinking of Room by Anna Donahue. I mean, it's through the eyes of a five-year-old, but it's really written for an adult perspective, and adults play a much larger role in it. So I hesitate to put YA into a box, but I can say that for me, YA is about telling a story through the perspective of someone who doesn't necessarily have the lens to really look at it retrospectively. Like, YA is very in the present. You know, YA is mm-hmm. very granular and like into the details and into the now and the pathos and the drama. And it's about, YA is about coming of age, understanding, you know, who the monsters actually are underneath your bed. Yeah.
So I just want to like move on to your newest book, This Is My Brain in Love. You seem to have a knack for writing about teens grappling with stigma, because in your book, you have two racial minority teens who are grappling mm-hmm. with mental illness. And you mentioned yeah. earlier that you personally went through depression yourself. So I just want to ask you, like, what was the process of developing this novel? Like, what was, what compelled you to write it?
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny when you write a first book and like the task of writing a second book is so monumental. It's like, it really came to me over a long time. It took me a long time between books. It was 5 years. I will say that I realized pretty early on that I did want to write what I like to call a happy book about mental illness, because I do feel that so much of the media representation around anxiety, depression these days is really focused on the act of death by suicide. And that's, of course, natural. That's the most dramatic component, the most dramatic endpoint to all of this. But for me, I know the journey through anxiety and depression was so long, and there were so many steps at which I could have reached out or asked for help. And looking back, I never really had the language to talk about it growing up. And so that's what I wanted to explore, because I think that, like I said, the act of suicide, I really wanted to write a book that about depression that did not have an act of suicide, because I think that for some people, and me growing up especially, if you didn't try to commit suicide, there's no way you could have been depressed. You know, like, there was no room for that spectrum. And so a lot of people end up hurting or not telling people about that because they don't feel like they're sad enough, or, you know, their problems aren't that bad. And I see this both with myself and with my family, that people use the most extreme examples of mental illness as an excuse not to seek help in some ways, you know what I mean? And I would say that for the book, the actual proximal event, the proximal reason I wanted to write that story was because, you know, it's funny, I actually ended up living in a town that's pretty similar to the one I grew up with, in that it's not terribly racially diverse, but there used to be a very good Chinese takeout restaurant that I absolutely loved, it reminded me of, you know, my family's food growing up. And it was in this hole in the wall in this shopping strip that was essentially abandoned, like right next to a bank. No one went there. But I remember going there once, and it was totally family run, you know, immigrant cashier and cooks and owners. But the one day I went in, there was this tall, gawky white dude trying to make sushi behind the counter. And I was like, oh my gosh, there has to be a story behind that. He has to have a crush on the owner's daughter or something like that. And that was what sort of inspired the story of, you know, this immigrant family and their daughter, and using the restaurant as a focus for a relationship, but also talking about the realities of struggling businesses, because that restaurant did close down. It was, you know, and it's something that I've always had this real empathy for businesses that close down. I don't know why, but it always is really devastating to me. My local independent bookstore closed down twice, actually. And so those types of things affect me so much because it's not just the place, it's the community that they build and the relationships that get formed there that I really mourn the loss of. But as I was developing the story, I wanted mental illness to be part of it. I wanted there to be a sense that crazy is the new normal. Reclaim that sense we're crazy and know that the majority of the people that we will meet on the street will have some element of neuroatypia. It was really interesting to me when I started doing the promotion for this book, how few of my friends actually knew that I had anxiety and depression. In a sense, writing this book was like coming out with mental illness, because my best friend from college, she actually got interviewed for a feature on a local newspaper. And afterwards she called me and was like, Eileen, why didn't you tell me everything you went through? I mean, she felt like a bad friend because she didn't know about it. And the same is true of like my family members. I've had people come out to me that, you know, I've known all my life or for decades to tell me, oh yeah, I've been on these medications too. And it's just, again, another example of why we need to talk about these issues, not just destigmatize it, but also make people more comfortable talking about it freely, because a lot of people don't necessarily feel stigmatized, but they still feel private about it. And I think that I was one of those people.
Yeah, definitely. I could relate because, as someone who has generalized anxiety disorder and clinical depression, I related to Jocelyn and Will's inner monologue so much. Mm-hmm. Was it always the plan to have two POVs alternate?
Yes, absolutely. Because I know, I mean, for a while in college, I did do a little bit of cognitive behavioral therapy. And so I've always been amazed at how well cognitive behavioral therapy can, I like to say, basically fact check the fake news in your brain. And I knew immediately that this had to be a dual point of view first things, because I wanted to be able to show that on the page, how two people can look at one incident through completely different lens. It was hard. It was definitely hard. This is actually the second time I wrote something in double POV. Believe it or not, none of the above was initially in two-person POV. It was Kristen, the intersex person, and then Darren, the boy who fell in love with her, because I really wanted to get into his head. And it was funny. A lot of people actually in that book who read the original manuscript liked Darren better, like Darren's POV better. But in the end, I had to take him out because it really was Kristen's story. But in this one, I stuck to my guns, and I had to do a lot of rewriting to make Will's character more authentic and get into his headspace. But it was, like I said, I just could not have imagined writing it without the dual narrative to show just how your brain just messes you up sometimes and turns you around in ways that a lot of people looking from the outside can't anticipate.
Yeah, anxiety and depression are often two sides of the same coin. So I really appreciated that you had these two teens with very different but very similar ways of creating fake news in their head. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like romance has a lot of like misunderstandings, mm-hmm. and it's mm-hmm. kind of inevitable. And mm-hmm. it's, you know, with two people with mental illnesses where they distort the truth, mm-hmm. there's going to be more misunderstandings. So mm-hmm. I really liked the prologue that you set in your book, because mm-hmm. you upfront say that this is a happy story. This isn't a book that's going to rip your heart out at the end, and that there is hope in it. Moving on, what I thought your book did exceptionally well was show how family, culture, and privilege impact the way we perceive mental illness. Will is from an upper middle class family, and he was mm-hmm. diagnosed at a young age mm-hmm. and sees a professional, whereas Jocelyn is from a working class Chinese American family mm-hmm. and she's undiagnosed. So I just want to ask you, like, why did you decide to have those two differences mm-hmm. for your two protagonists?
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons. Number one, I am like completely aware of how inequality exacerbates like people's access to mental health treatment. I mean, I remember when I was a poor resident, like how I felt like, you know, even being able to pay for therapy was such a stretch. But number two, I also really wanted to subvert the Asian American model minority stereotype. And like, that was something I knew I wanted to do really, really early on, was to not have my Asian character be the straight A, you know, Ivy League bound person, and to actually have the Black character be the one who was more upper middle class and who was the model student per se. And I'm so glad that you picked up on that and appreciated that, because it was something that I did very, very consciously, because you know, I'm aware of the own privilege that I give my children, for instance, because of who I am. That, you know, I've given them access to therapy really early on before they, quote, needed it, even according to my own family members. But I know that there are so many, especially within the Asian American population, there's so much stigma and shame attached to it. And it's not something that people prioritize from a financial standpoint, because so many people have struggled just to pay the bills, to eat. It seems like such a luxury to be able to spend, you know, three figures on a single therapy session.
Mm, yeah, definitely. It is a deterrent for a lot of Asian American families. And I think it was one of Will's family members that says, you know, in Nigeria, they don't believe in mental illnesses. They believe that it's an American disease. And I think that's kind of a similar mindset that a lot of Asian American families have. We mm-hmm. don't really have the tools or the language to discuss mental health. Mm-hmm. So Will, it's like Will is Black. He's mm-hmm. actually mixed race, and mm-hmm. Jocelyn is Chinese American, as we said, and they both face microaggressions mm-hmm. and, I just wanted to pick your brain in why you decided to make the couple interracial and feature these microaggressions. Like, what? Why was it important to you to feature that in the book?
I think that the racial microaggressions, I mean, there's this whole concept of minority stress. You know, the idea that all minorities, when they have to overcome prejudices or instances of that where they might have more anxiety in a situation than other people, like that wears on it. Even today, in reading a New York Times article on why the coronavirus has hit African American communities so hard, like they talk about this idea of weathering. In other words, that like the constant stress of like being, you know, being minority, being discriminated against, like systemic inequality, like plays a role in worsening both physical and mental health, which makes you vulnerable to other things. And I mean, microaggressions were something that I never knew existed until after college, probably graduate school. I always internalized the little paper cuts and like the little insults and the little side sideways bits of praise, the little and I don't think I really understood the damage that that did until later on, and I did feel like, again, that's something that I wanted to write into the story that I wish I had had as a teenager. And giving people the language to be able to identify that, and in identifying that, realize that other people share that and can commiserate and, you know, help you almost turn it into a joke or a meme. There's nothing more alienating than feeling like you've been insulted, but that no one can understand that you've been insulted, I think. That was part of what I wanted to do in writing about that and actually having the two teams be able to connect over that.
Yeah. And it's, and Will's race is actually a really big factor into the relationship, because Jocelyn's dad kind of comes up with this contract, say, if you want to date my daughter, these are the tasks you must do.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I thought the contract was really cute. But I did really like the fact that you mentioned how Asians have internalized racist ideas, and they not only have it towards Black people, but they also have it within subsets of the Asian community.
I had a much more in-depth analysis of that that unfortunately didn't make it through edits because I thought it'd be too alienating, but someday I'll unearth that. I don't know, maybe as an extra to to people in the Asian community, because I have countless really funny episodes from, you know, my family and friends and how that Asian and Asian crime, it definitely exists.
Yeah, like, and especially towards like Asian communities against Black communities. I remember growing up, my parents giving me the whole like no dating until college talk, and them saying like, these are the people you can date. Mm-hmm. And these are not.
Yep.
And
yep.
Unfortunately, like the these are not were Black people. And it was like the first time when I realized that that there was this stigma, there was this racial, like internalized racism. And you know, like as a child of immigrants, you kind of try to excuse that for your parents, because it's like, oh, they don't understand, like they came from a different country, but at some point it's not acceptable. And I really like the fact that you made Jocelyn stand up to them at some point. I thought that was like a really poignant scene in your book. I'm guessing that was something that you really wanted to show, right?
Yeah, no, I had the same exact conversation with my mom, and like, except she also included white people because they, quote, they only want one thing, and then went down a list of every type of Asian. She decided the only person I could date was a Taiwanese American.
Wow, that's like, very specific.
Very specific. It was priceless.
As much as this is a falling in love story, this is also a story about family and a story about like a child of immigrants trying to understand her parents and just kind of bridging this gap. And one of the relationships that I really loved was the father and with Jocelyn, because you have Jocelyn's father, who is very, I guess the nice way to put it is conservative, very protective. Was that a relationship that you had with your parents? Like, is that something that transitioned onto the page?
I definitely think there were definitely aspects of that, from, you know, my personal life and from the friends of the parents of other friends. I don't think it's uncommon at all. I feel like a lot of my Asian friends were kind of nodding their heads along with some of the characterizations, because it is a generational difference. Definitely. It's in people who came from a very different place and with very different struggles are going to be protective of their own. I might understand that.
I liked how, like Joss's father wasn't okay with her dating until college, but then another Asian dad in town says, "No, I like it's okay for your kid to date. You have to be more modern." And it was just a small thing, but mm-hmm. it just kind of showed that all Asian parents aren't the same.
Yes. Yeah. No. Yeah. I definitely wanted to do that as well. Even though it wasn't in my experience, I have heard of those parents.
Not all of us can be Peggy Chang and have a cool dad. I was also so impressed by like the kids' ingenuity when it came to marketing and business strategies to save the restaurant. Like, how did you come up with those? Did you ask teens to brainstorm with you?
No, I did a lot of Googling, and there are lots like Harvard Business Review, and like there are lots of different strategies, because I mean it's a big problem. And honestly, I use some of the techniques that you use as an author, right, to promote and get visitors. I'm also very much a thrifty, cheap Asian at heart. And so like, I'm all about like knowing the power of coupons, even though it is a fallacy, like, people give you a coupon, so you'll buy more. I think I came up based on, how I would market if I were, running a business, but a lot comes from being an author and having to market that way. And then also some tips online. There are definitely a lot of blogs out there and websites on, how to bring traffic. But some of it's just observed from looking at going to some restaurants that I like, local restaurants I know, and realizing, being appalled at how little of a social media they have, like how they haven't necessarily curated their Yelp page. But and understanding the generational gap between like how people just don't know how people are finding restaurants these days. There are a lot of places I know that don't even have Facebook pages. Like I literally went to a local Chinese restaurant that, was very, very much struggling. You could tell. And so I went and I was like, I can help you make a Facebook page. And they were like, "Do you have to pay for that?"
Oh my God.
No. So, I mean, really, like this is real life. And yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of a lot of businesses now in like our little Tokyo neighborhood here in LA are on Grubhub for the first time, or on online ordering services for the first time because of necessity, but also because there are young people who are invested in these businesses surviving, helping them modernize.
Yeah. And that's a great way for the community to get around it. And now that people have time where they can do that type of thing, that's really one of those rare silver linings of this time. That's really great. That makes me really happy to know that, because my grandfather owned his own medical practice, but like very, very randomly, he also owned a gas station convenience store in one of the towns surrounding Utica, New York. And I remember going there and thinking the place looks like our basement, which means totally disorganized, and like, having ideas in my head and how it could be better, but not really wanting to have anything to do with it. So this is all a little bit coming from personal experience. And I think I do have a natural inclination towards like wanting to get an extra buck. So if I were a business person, this is what I would do.
I mean, when I was reading the book, I was like, wow, these kids are so savvy. Like, what was I doing when I was in high school? I definitely did not have the skills that kids have these days. Oh, God, I sound so old by saying like these days, but
these days,
they
are, though. They are really good. Like, I actually hired a high school student to be my social media intern now, and she's been amazing. I will give a shout out to Kim Le. I don't know how to pronounce her name, whether she pronounces it Le or Le. But I'll tag her maybe when I retweet this, because she's been amazing. Like, she actually taught me Instagram a little bit, and has been helping me out a lot of stuff, because it's a generational thing. And of course, my 10-year-old daughter is teaching me about TikTok. So yay.
So Jocelyn and her best friend Priya are cinephiles. They're really into movies, particularly older ones on the AFI list. And they kind of categorize their life events into movie tropes, which I thought was like a really cute element to your book. Are you a big movie buff as well? Or was that something you had to research?
I definitely am. Less so now than when I was younger. But yeah, I'm like constantly checking IMDb, and I'm definitely compared to, say, my husband, who thought that Ang Lee and Spike Lee were the same person, I'm definitely a cinemaphile. I think that obviously movies are like kind of a shortcut to stories, and they're, I think, for someone growing up again in a really small insular place, like they're really an avenue to see other places and to really inhabit the world of other people. And I think that movies in some ways, definitely movies have this moment, that this place in our culture that is both good and bad because of how they can either perpetuate tropes or invert them. And I think that because one of the things I wanted to do in writing the book was to subvert some stereotypes, like I came upon this idea of using tropes as Jocelyn's thing pretty early on, because I am kind of obsessed with the TV Tropes website. I'll admit it. It's like, you can just go down in a rabbit. Oh my gosh,
it's
such a rabbit hole. You can go there. And it's so spot on though, like how you can see the way that Hollywood writers have like latched onto these generic ideas that like have so much resonance, you know. It's amazing. It's really amazing. And so I was really happy to be able to use that, because I think it's a great lens for that kids can use to sort of suss out what's real and what's not, and also to help them make sense of the world. But it can also be a good way in for kids to think about their thought processes, and like sort of, it can almost help you with cognitive behavioral therapy in that, like, it can say, okay, this thought is a trope. You know, how can I do something different, do something original, do something more real?
Do you have a favorite trope?
Oh, no. I don't think anyone can have a favorite trope.
What's your favorite YA trope?
Oh, geez.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
Because for Rira, it's the fake.
Yeah, Frankly in Love. Yeah, yes. Definitely. That's a good trope. Oh man. You know what? My favorite trope in general is, and I don't know what the exact name of it, but is the trope of the enemy that you later become friends with.
Oh, I think they call it enemy
to
friend.
Yeah, the enemy to friend trope.
Yeah.
Because I think of like all the classic books of my youth, like Bridget Terabithia, how like that mean girl ends up being like, she befriends the mean girl. And like, yeah. So I love that trope. I love you utilizing that. And even though it never really happens in real life, I like the idea of it.
I really like Priya as a character. And how she's a friend to Jocelyn. She is so supportive, and she tries to be so positive for Jocelyn, trying to build her up, saying, don't be so hard on yourself. But also, Priya doesn't really quite know how to seek help for Jocelyn, and it's a struggle that Will has as well. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's a common... It's common for a lot of people who know people with mental illnesses. Mm-hmm. And with Jocelyn, I think it was, I guess, like really, really powerful to me, because she is still undiagnosed, and because mm-hmm. she grew up in a family that doesn't really believe in seeking even just doctors for normal ailments. She's like really hesitant to go seek help. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, was, like, you said earlier that a lot of your friends didn't know that you had depression, and that there's no way that they could have known the best way to help you. Mm-hmm. I really don't know how to form a question because I was just so impressed by how authentic that was. Like, yeah. How do you help someone who doesn't want to be helped?
Yeah. I feel like I've experienced it from both ways. I've experienced it from the point of view of someone who's depressed, but then has a friend whose life always seems to be great and happy, you know? And like, they're the type of friend that you go to and they're like always trying to give you advice. And it stings because they don't quite get it, you know? And I think that unless you've experienced depression, sometimes it can seem like it's almost imaginary to some people. Just think positive thoughts and everything will be fine, you know? And so I've experienced it from that way, that perspective. I've also experienced it from the opposite perspective. In other words, being friends with or in love with someone who needs help but will not get it. I think in my experience, men in general have been a lot more reluctant to seek help, kind of like how they don't want to ask for directions when they're lost. I definitely have at least two relationships where I felt like I've had, you know, the more I suggest it, the more they dig in. And that is very true. Like Jocelyn's digging in, like her bristling, her defensiveness. When Will suggests that she could talk to someone is definitely from really my real experience. And it's tough. I get it.
So just wrapping up, you said that you're not reading as much nowadays, but is there a book that have caught your eye recently?
Oh gosh, where to start? I actually have a lot of audiobooks that I'm like partway through. Like I'm partway through Stacey Lee's Downstairs Girl. I'm really looking forward to Samira Ahmed's next book, Bad, Mad, and Dangerous to Know. I'm really looking forward to the obvious ones are like Liz Acevedo's next book. I'm still behind on Lamar Giles is one of my favorite people, and I'm a couple of books behind on him. He's like too prolific though. He's written too many books, the jerk. There's so many books I want to plug.
You're just listing my TBR right now.
I'm sorry.
I feel so guilty because I haven't gotten to them.
there are people on who I'm going to be on like virtual tour with, and like, I haven't, you know, I've read their, you know, earlier books, but haven't read their latest books. So like Emery Lord, you know, Jasmine Warga, Eric Smith, it's like, oh, help me guys. But actually this is where coronavirus does help. I got a lot more time to read now, but, or at least listen on audiobook. There are lots and lots of books that I want to read right now. And it's just too much, but in a good way, in a good way. Means I have a lot of books to recommend.
Yeah. Speaking of virtual tour, so obviously the coronavirus has hampered a lot of our normal like operations in the book industry. How can people find out more about your book?
Yeah. So just today, actually, I announced on my blog that I'm doing a virtual tour to support. I call it this is my brain in love with indie bookstores. Tour. And so I'm partnering with 8 independent booksellers, and each one is going to be hosting a different virtual event with some of my favorite authors and people. And we're just going to go around, do different virtual events, different times a day throughout the next week or two. And hopefully if people buy the books through those any bookstores, I'm going to have a giveaway. People will be randomly enter a drawing for a $100 gift certificate to bookshop.com. And then I'm also offering a secret teacher package, which includes a gift certificate, but also a 20 book classroom set for their class and a Skype visit. Because I know that so many teachers are having to move online these days. And I obviously, it could be a Zoom visit since that's the tool of choice these days. And I'm hoping that we can still reach students and convince them that, you know, why literature really can be such a balm for these times and help them navigate through anxiety when there's so much going on in their life.
So you mentioned earlier that you're involved with We Need Diverse Books, and you're actually a founding member of that organization, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that We Need Diverse Books owes everything to Twitter, you know, because it was a way for a lot of people who wouldn't normally be able to get together because of geography to realize they were on the same page and with their frustrations with their with the publishing industry, but also with their hopes for what it could be and how it could start amplifying the voices of diverse authors and really stimulating intense positive discussions on the power of representation and how publishers really need to know how to sell diverse books. I feel that being part of the We Need Diverse team was one of the most stressful times of my life, but also the most rewarding because it's something that you can see tangible change from in so many aspects of the publishing industry. I mean, it's really amazing. And part of the strengths of the We Need Diverse Books campaign is, number one, that it was inclusive of all types of diversity. You know, it isn't just about race. It's also about ability and religion and sexual diversity. And number two is that it realized that the problem with the lack of diversity is systemic. You know, it's not just the editors for not buying the book. It's because the marketing team doesn't necessarily know how to push it. It's because the sales team are worried, quote, that the book, and this is something I was told for None of the Above, that it was a tough sell. And I'm like, no, I don't think it's a tough sell if you know how to sell it. You know, if you know how to push it. And the other thing is that, you know, we really get into the guts of the industry because we Need Diverse Books establish an internship program to get people at the ground level because the publishing industry is one of privilege, definitely, right? In order to work in it, you have to be able to live in New York City. You need to be educated. You need to be able to afford living in New York City on a very low wage, you know, having unpaid internships. We have to realize that privilege extends to other people, other what they call gatekeepers within the publishing industry, namely teachers and librarians. Majority of teachers and librarians are also white. And so by reaching out to the American Library Association, to English teachers, the NCTE conference, We Need Diverse Books really made this something that's discussed across the whole population of readers. And I think that was where its success lied. Booksellers too. Booksellers, especially indie booksellers, are so crucial. And I always like to say that it's a truth universally known that a diverse book is in need of a teacher, librarian, or bookseller to promote it.
For sure. And it's really exciting to have you on because I think Rira and I have been talking about having someone from We Need Diverse Books on the podcast since I think we started almost 3 years ago.
Yeah, because We Need Diverse Books started in 2015, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And 2014 technically.
Oh, 2014. Right? Yeah, because we started in 2016.
Oh, so, yeah.
So it wasn't like that. We Need Diverse Books was still very young, and we've kind of seen how it has grown into this huge movement and how it has changed publishing, especially in children's literature. And yeah, it's amazing, but at the same time, disappointing to see that change has been, I guess because things have stayed the same in publishing for so long, it just seems that like any change that happens is like monumental, and it's like,
yes,
it should have happened a long time ago. And
it's
a little bit sad that we're like really happy about it.
Yeah. Yeah. We've done a lot, but there's still a lot to be done.
Yes,
and that's
yes.
true of everything in the world. It's easy to be upset about things that still need to change. But I think that it's also really empowering to realize that we have made change. We've definitely moved the needle for a lot of titles. So I'm excited about that.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. And
thank you guys.
We wish you the best of luck with your virtual tour. And just a closing statement from me. I wish I had your book when I was younger, because I feel like it would have helped helped with my mental illness and helped me navigate it. So I'm sure that there will be teen readers out there who will be grateful for reading it. So I wish you the best of luck and best of success.
Thank you so much for having me and for getting the book. I mean, it's so amazing to write something and have people actually appreciate the things that you tried to do. I'm like, oh my, it's, you know, when you're writing and sitting in your desk, you're just like, do these words make sense? Do they say what I think they mean? And thank you. You've set my heart at ease. I feel like I'm done. Okay. I'm good. Thank you.
If people want to follow you on social media, where can they go?
Yep. IW Gregorio, and Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and then my website.
Well, thank you so much for taking your time to talk with us. Good luck with the book launch. And
thank you so much.
And that was our interview with Eileen Wong. We'd like to thank her so very much for joining us on Books and Boba. That was a really good conversation. Yeah, huh?
We went places. We dug deep.
Yeah, and a quick reminder for everyone that our Books and Boba book club pick for April 2020 is Mimi Lee Gets a Clue. So hope you all are busy reading that. Again, if you have any thoughts, please let us know on our Goodreads group. We always love to hear from our book club members on Goodreads so we can incorporate your feedback into our discussion podcast episode. I just loaded up the book on my Kindle, so I'm really excited to dig into it, especially now when we're all kind of just stuck indoors.
Yeah, maybe we should start a Discord so that we feel less lonely.
I was just thinking that, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Great minds think alike.
As we're quarantined here in LA, you know, thinking of ways to improve everyone's book club experience. But as always, thanks for joining us on Books and Boba.
And we'll see you next week for our mid-month episode where we talk about the latest publishing news.
I feel like there's been a bunch. Huh.
I feel really guilty for saying this, but I really haven't been checking book Twitter lately. Twitter is a bad place right now because there's just so much news about coronavirus and just independent bookstores struggling and small businesses going out of business. And yeah, it's pretty depressing.
And maybe piracy, right?
Oh yeah, piracy. That was a big thing. Yeah.
Well, we'll see y'all next time on Books and Boba. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Ri Ryu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @BooksandBoba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
But we're still here. And we're going strong.
It's an exciting time in Asian America. There are more movies, TV shows, books, and music reflecting us than ever. But all of these represent just a small slice of Asian American culture and experiences. So what do? Tell more slices. Asian Americana is a show that explores these slices of distinctly Asian American culture and history. We've talked about how Chinese Americans built California's Sacramento Delta, the art scene turns gallery institution Giant Robot, a play that explores the lost Cambodian pop music of the 60s and 70s, and, of course, Boba, just to name a few stories. You can find Asian Americana at asianamericana.com or on your podcast app.